This is just a letter that I'm sending to Meridel and Alan and talking to Betty, who is sitting here in our little hideaway in Weymouth, New Jersey. Unfortunately, we didn't have the tape going at the beginning, so we'll just step back and you can enter the conversation at the moment when I asked Betty what Alan was working on for his thesis. And she spoke about Woody Guthrie as a topic, and I said that was very interesting. And for reasons that I'll take up in a moment, we started to talk then about Mary Austin, right? And author of The American Rhythm. And I said, one of the questions I would like Meridel and Alan to answer on a return tape, or maybe in writing, is the following. In his anthology, Modern Poetry, Louis Untermeyer mentions the Indian poetry in his preface to the 1919 edition. And I'll quote from that. He says, "The Indian has been as difficult to adopt poetically as he has been to assimilate ethnically. Nevertheless, in spite of the fact that the white and red races are worlds apart in sentiment, philosophy, and attitudes to life, many gallant attempts have been made to bring the spirit of the Indian into our literature. Mary Austin, in spite of a far-fetched theory and unsound conclusions, has made an extended study of the matter in the book called The American Rhythm." End of quote. The question is, what is there in The American Rhythm that can be described, as Untermeyer does, far-fetched theory and unsound conclusions? I would like to get the opinion of our friends in Minneapolis on this question. From The American Indian and Mary Austin and Louis Untermeyer, we moved on into the reason that I thought very interesting for Alan to be working in the field of folk song at this stage of the game, because so am I. And it is a theme in my new book. Of course, I have been involved in the folk song movement in this country for many years. And we used to have a wisecrack about it. Lee Hayes would get up and sing a song and introduce it by saying, "I will now sing you a little folk song that Walter and I wrote last night." And one of the interesting things about folk song is the fact that it is not written by folk. Every folk song is written by somebody, some individual, like a Woody Guthrie. Just happens that we know Woody personally, or Lee Hayes. But all the songs that we know were written by an individual, and the thing that makes them folk songs is that they are taken up and become the property of the general public. And the author, even when his name is known, tends to become anonymous. So we know the name of the man, Keating, who wrote Tending Tonight. But it's a matter of research to find this out almost, because everybody thinks of it as the a national sentiment. Previously, when Alan and I discussed poetry and the origins of poetry and the influences of poetry, we spoke about the worldwide influences. I remember an Alan Will when he came to 4510 Regent Street and I pointed to the map on the wall, and he wrote a poem about it later. I showed him Asia and India, Africa, all the influences at work on world culture, that we were not necessarily the center of that movement of world culture, that it has sources that go far, far back ethnologically, geographically, in many parts of the world. And in the United States, we are a very, our heritage is a very recent one, and one that is not too easy always to fathom or to find. And one of the problems that we face as artists is the our stability, because if we don't have roots that go deep into our own native soil as well as world culture, we tend to be like a boat without a center board, swaying this way and that way without giving people a definite feeling as to where we come from and where we're heading. So, over the last few years, I tried to graft onto myself as much as possible a different type of cultural heritage than many of us have grown up with. And this is what I think Alma and I discussed. If you recall that map, I pointed out to him that we were all children in this country through our educational system of what I call the Greco-Roman, Anglo-Saxon, Franco-German, Hispanic culture, with its roots back in the Homeric period in Greece, and following all those countries that I've just indicated in that Greco-Roman, Anglo-Saxon tradition. And this, of course, is a very great tradition. One that's influenced everybody who writes today. But it's the tradition of the past, I said to Alan, as I recall, that to my knowledge, we have not gotten our roots into the heritage, the world heritage of culture, which is now, which we see now, belongs, has a long history. In those countries who are making the future today, in other words, the culture of China, of India, of Africa, of Asia, and of the Soviet Union and new people's democracy, the Slavic culture. You look through anthologies of world poetry in this country, even the more liberal of them, and you find very few references to anything east of Greece. If there is a reference, it's a sort of quaintness about it. I mean, there's a quaint reference. But the fact is that during the period of the so-called Dark Ages in Europe, between the fall of Rome, between the great poets of Rome, between the days of Horace and Catullus and so forth, and Virgil, till the time of the poets of Provence and Dante, Petrarch, during that whole period, poetry in China reached a peak that has never been surpassed and has rarely been equaled in the poets of the Tang period. Tu Fu, for example. These are poets that are only recently becoming part of the world of our heritage, although they've been part of world heritage for a long while. So without going into a long speech on this aspect, I'm just recalling the need that I felt at that time to feel a part of this tradition as well as the Greco-Roman tradition. Well, this involved simply immersing myself in other literatures other, let me say, than the Western European tradition, and incorporating their influence in my own work and doing some translations. And I've pursued that. But recently, having gotten what I feel is a sort of balance in my own approach to these questions, I found it necessary to re-examine the whole American situation. And I did this as if I were starting from scratch. And I dismissed the idea that I used to have, I used to share, I think, with many people, and that I think that Untermeyer indicated in his preface that the Indian heritage was one that you didn't graft onto the American heritage. And I began to examine what were the roots on the origins and the traditions in American soil of an American culture. And I find that the Indians have made the best contributions in the United States as well as in Mexico. Let me rephrase that. When you go below the border, you find in Mexico a great culture today in painting, in other Latin American countries, that is reaching a peak in painting. In other Latin American countries, it's a very high order in other arts, poetry. Some of the greatest poets in the world come from Latin America. Neruda, Mistral, for example. Just in one country, Chile. The artists, the living artists in these countries have their roots not only in the Spanish culture and the Spanish language which they speak, but in their Indian background, ethnologically, geographically, in every way. This is the heartbeat, you might say, of Latin American culture. But here in this country, due to the origin of our civilization, the way the Indians were wiped out and put into concentration camps, we have tended to do the same thing with them culturally. And this has robbed us, in my opinion, of part of our own native tradition. I've tried to indicate that in a way, to some slight degree, in this new book that I'm working on. And it's on this score that Mary Austin I find very interesting, because without going into great detail on it, she seems to have had an approach that the place where a poem is written has a big influence on the poem, as well as the surroundings and the whole civilization out of which it comes. So if we're Americans, how does our American rhythm today relate to the kind of poetry that was written and spoken and sung by the Indians and is today? It would be abstract to dismiss this. And yet you can go through the anthologies, and if you find a poem with an Indian source, it's probably the one by Chief Joseph, in which he says he's not going to fight anymore. But, it's a very fine little piece, but there are many, many very great Indian poems in this country, which have been very infrequently adapted into English. And if I could have a footnote, this is one of the interesting things about Martin Carver, the English-speaking poet of British Guiana. Martin Carver writes in English. He's a Negro, and he lives in a country that is, has a vast tradition in Indian law and in the history of the Negro people who became part of this colony. And he writes in English with a certain sort of primitive tang to his language that I never found in any other English-speaking poet. It gives us some feeling of this character of non-Western culture when it speaks out of a American environment. Close footnote. Resuming the main thread, so to speak. Mind you, this is just a letter and a talk. I'm not writing this. I don't have this well enough in hand to do anything about it except to talk about it and to incorporate it in the book that I'm working on. Following this native Indian influence that I'm just beginning to try to assemble in my mind, hold it. We have to go back. When I spoke 2 or 3 years ago about the origins of poetry and in its relation to dance and work and so forth, all these references either were expressly or by inference related to the primitive times in other lands. And what I'm trying to say is that these same origins exist in our country. You don't have to go back to the ceremonies of the Greeks Dionysus and so forth. We have these similar situations in this country, and it's not to dismiss their influence on our country, but to relate this culture to our own native origins, because we have the same sort of invocations, the use of the magic, use of the word, and all these world influences on culture can be found in one way or the other, or rather many of them, right here. So why shouldn't we feel them consciously, rather than, as Caldwell does and other aestheticians, always basing ourselves only on the Greek or Roman or Western European primitive cultures, as far as the origins of the dance or the poem or the music and so forth. Is that clear? Another influence that we are conscious of, some of us, but haven't been explicit about, is the influence of the labor movement, of the working class movement in this country, on poetry, and the influence that it has through folk song very often. Because if we look in the history of the labor movement in this country, we find that we, as for example in Fauna's history, that very often there were songs and rhyme verse was used by workers in various struggles. In fact, you could write a history of the American labor movement through the songs that it produced. Every struggle has a song, and this is very, there's a literature on this subject, but it's a literature of folk song, and it isn't considered as part of the history of American poetry. Now, my only thought on the matter is, I have no original contribution, is that there shouldn't be this dual approach. Now, on the one hand you have folk song, and on the other hand you have art song. I have never felt this way. This is something that I've had in my mind for many, many years. I thought the Beale Street Blues was a piece on the order that could rank with a Schumann or Schubert song. I never felt that the Beale Street Blues was in one world and the Schubert Lieder were another. Or Alexander's Ragtime Band. Or folk songs like Which Side Are You On? Are great songs. So I don't make this difference, never have. And yet, it's implicit in everything that is said by the professionals about American literature. They, to a large extent, there may be exceptions, to a large extent, it's a literature of artwork, and its origins are lost. So if we go through the songbooks that the labor movement has gotten out over the past 100 years, we find a number of pieces that are not worth much, and we find some that are worth much. For example, on the new record, just gotten out, by Pete Seeger, called Industrial Ballads, we find a number of these songs from the songs influenced by or coming out of the American labor or radical movement. I'm going to play one of them for you. Dates from 1801. It's called Pagan Hall, and the note says that it provides an unusual social commentary on the first ravages of industrialization and the ensuing technological unemployment on a shoemaker. The next voice you will hear will be Pete Seeger singing this song.
In the days of 1801, pagan all. In the days of 1801, pagan all. In the days of 1801, peggin' shoes was all I done. Hand me down my pegs, my pegs, my pegs, my all. In the days of 1802, peggin' all. In the days of 1802, peggin' all. In the days of 1802, peggin' shoes was all I'd do. Hand me down my pegs, my pegs, my pegs, my all. 18 and 3, pagan all. In the days of 18 and 3, pagan all. In the days of 18 and 3, pagan shoes was all you'd see. Hand me down my pegs, my pegs, my pegs, my all. In the days of 18 and 4, pagan all. In the days of 18 and 4, pagan all. In the days of 18 and 4, I said I'd peg those shoes no more. Throw away my pegs, my pegs, my pegs, my all. They've invented a new machine, pagan all. They've invented a new machine, pagan all. They've invented a new machine, prettiest little thing you ever seen. Throw away my pegs, my pegs, my pegs, my all. Makes 100 pairs to my one, pagan all. Makes 100 pairs to my one, pagan all. Makes 100 pairs to my one, pagan shoes, it ain't no fun. Throw away my pegs, my pegs, my pegs, my pegs, my all.
The labor movement has produced a number of songs which will illustrate further the point I'm trying to make here. Some of them are in this album. Many of them are still only available in book form. However, there's one that came out of the Gastonia, Holland and Bell County mine struggles of the 30s. Some of you may have remembered a story I had in The Worker a few weeks ago where I mentioned covering a strike, a coal disaster in Pineville, Kentucky about 1945, and meeting an old friend of the paper for which I was working, the Daily Worker. In this mine town. When I got back to New York, some old timers told me, refreshed my memory rather, about the days of the early 30s when the minefield was being organized, and one of the people who was a victim of that organizing struggle was Harry Sims. Now, one of the best ballads of the country is the ballad of Death of Harry Sims. And that's the next one I'm going to play for you, because it gives a better impression of the point I'm trying to make. It's a song that was written by a miner, friend of Harry Sims, and sung by Aunt Molly Jackson. But the record you're going to hear is the way it's performed by Pete Seeger.
Come and listen to my story, come and listen to my song. I will tell you of a hero who's now dead and gone. I will tell you of a young boy whose age was 19. He was the bravest Union man that I have ever seen. Harry Sims was a pal of mine, we labored side by side, expecting to be shot on sight or taken for a ride by them dirty coal operator gun thugs that roam from town to town, a-shooting down the Union men where'er they may be found. Harry Sims was walking down the track one bright sunshiny day. He was a youth of courage, his step was light and gay. He did not know the gun fox was hiding on the way to kill our brave young comrade this bright sunshiny day. Harry Sims was killed on Brush Creek in 1932. He organized the miners into the NMU. He gave his life in struggle, that was all that he could do. He died for the Union, also for me and you.
I'm going back in history now to a song considered by many the greatest of our Western ballads, called The Buffalo Skinners. It dates from about 1873, from the period of the great buffalo hunt. I'm using it to illustrate the peak performance, musically, in my opinion, of the vast literature of songs and poetry from the farmers and cowboys and Western unindustrialized sections of our country. The next voice you hear will be Pete Seeger singing the Buffalo Singers, Buffalo Skinners.
Twas in the town of Jacksboro in the spring of 73, a man by the name of Krieger come stepping up to me. Said, how do you do, young fellas, and how'd you like to go and spend one summer pleasantly on the range of the buffalo? It's me being out of employment, old Crego, I did say. This going out on the buffalo range depends upon the pay. But if you pay good wages and transportation too, I think, sir, I will go with you to the range of the buffalo. Well, it's now we've crossed Pease River, boys, our troubles they have begun. First old stinker that I cut, crashed how I cut my thumb. While skinning doggone old buffalo, our lives they had no show. For the Indians watched to pick us off while skinning the buffalo. The season being near over, old Crego, he did say. The crowd had been extravagant, was in debt to him that day. We coaxed him and we argued, but still it was no go. We left his damned old bones to bleach on the range of the buffalo. It's now we've crossed Pease River, and homeward we are bound. No more in that all-fired country will ever we be found. Go back to our wives and sweethearts, tell others not to go. For God's forsaken the buffalo range.
That's all the folk song we're going to hear today, and Betty's smiling at that. We're trying to lead up to Walter's book, but it's not only the native labor and folk traditions, it's also the vast literature of the Negro people and its culmination in the modern manner. And so to close this side of our tape, I'm going to give you a new recording by the Modern Jazz Quartet, which will indicate the type of music that has also influenced my poetry as well as many others. Thank you.